Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
Welcome to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast. I'm Paul Sweeney, along with my co-host, Lisa Abramowitz.
Each day, we bring you the most noteworthy and useful interviews for you and your money, whether you're at the grocery store or the trading floor.
Find a Bloomberg P&L Podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts, as well as at Bloomberg.com.
Markets higher today. Everything rally continues. I'm wondering, how long can this continue? So is everyone else on Wall Street. Joining us now to discuss is Urien Timmer, Fidelity Investments Director of Global Macro Research and Strategy. He is coming to us from our Boston studio. Urien, thank you so much for being with us. I want to start with, how long can the everything rally continue?
Well, from my experience, bull markets end for only a couple of reasons. You know, one, the main reason is that inflation ends up accelerating during the so-called late cycle stage of the business cycle, and that forces the Fed to essentially over-tighten more than the economy can handle. You get a recession, you get a bear market, and that's the end of the cycle. Obviously, we don't have that because inflation is persistently undershooting the Fed's target to such a degree that the Fed actually now has the free option to cut rates a couple of times, even though we are in a very advanced phase of the business cycle. So it's a very unusual cycle. But basically, in my opinion, this is not a linear system. So the cycle could theoretically continue, or it can slow and then get some new life in it. And I think that's probably what the Fed is trying to accomplish here, is to essentially extend the cycle and therefore extend the bull market. You know, the S&P or the Dow has been in a holding pattern now for about 18 months, just like it did back in late 14 to early 16. And we're pushing against that 3,000 level on the S&P. And if earnings season is okay and it doesn't come too much at the expense of coming quarters, and earnings do stage the rebound that the market is essentially expecting, and then the Fed throws a couple of rate cuts into the mix, then you could argue that the cycle can keep going.
So, Urien, it looks like it's been reported by some Chinese media that the U.S. trade delegation will be returning to Beijing next week. How important to the markets, to your outlook, is it to get a real deal done with China?
Trade, of course, is extremely important for the markets. You could, and for the economy as well, of course. But you could argue that it's actually more important for the markets than the real economy, because the real economy, led by 70% consumer spending, is doing pretty well. The consumer is in good shape. You know, debt levels are low, wages are rising, unemployment's at a 50-year low. So you could argue that if tariffs are a form of a tax and they get passed on to the consumer, that in the current economic environment, the economy might slow as a result of it, and we've already been seeing that, but that ultimately the economy will do okay. But then when you look at the S&P 500 and how that's really more of a global index, where companies are sort of geared or levered towards globalization in terms of very efficient supply chains and how that affects their profit margins and therefore their earnings growth, you can see the S&P actually being more vulnerable to a lack of progress on the trade front. And I think that's what we're essentially seeing, because since the first tariff was lobbed 18 months ago or so, the market, as I said before, hasn't really made much progress. And when you look at the earnings season in Q1, Q1 ended up beating expectations, but then coming at the expense of Q2, and Q2 looks like it's doing about the same thing. So if I'm a company in the U.S. And I rely on globalization to keep my profit margins high, and I don't know what the state of play is, I'm either going to do nothing for a while or I'm going to try to re-engineer those supply chains. But that's costly and that takes time as well. So I think that explains a lot of why we are where we are in the market. So it is very important. I don't have high expectations that a total, broadly encompassing deal will happen, but maybe there will be a few singles and doubles here along the way.
Jurjen, why would any investor want to trade this kind of backdrop?
Well, I don't really believe in trading so much. I believe in investing for the long term. And I think one of the drivers for this market is that we are in a 10-year expansion. We, as I said before, we don't have that inflation boogeyman, threatening to undo it. We also don't have a lot of pent-up, leverage types of bubbles, other than maybe corporate balance sheets. Go ahead.
Sorry. Yeah, no, but my point is, why not just do a 60-40 portfolio and leave it at that? I mean, you've got this sort of push-pull dynamic that's going to go on for a while, and everyone's saying it's range-bound. Why even think more about it? Do the 60-40, put it in, sleep on it, and not think again.
Yeah, I could not agree with you more. The strategic allocation, which is what you're referring to, is what drives most performance over the long term. Now, tactical allocation is important if the opportunity set is there. And you could argue maybe EM versus U.S. equity allocations are an opportunity set right now. We can talk about that. But the strategic allocation, whether it's 60-40, 70-30, or whatever it is, I think ultimately is what drives investors to achieving their ultimate goals. And I think it's very important to keep our eye on the prize and not try to overtrade something because maybe we get a 10% correction or even a 20% correction. We got one in December and the market immediately retraced that. So trading can be detrimental to our financial health. I agree.
So Jurjen, how concerned should I be about the economies outside of the U.S.? I'm thinking about Western Europe, very weak to weak, Brexit not helping. We've got China slowing, although still putting up some decent growth. Do I have to be concerned about that?
Well, global growth has been slowing for over a year. The J.P. Morgan global PMI peaked at 54.4, I think, more than a year ago, and is down at 49 and change. The U.S. sort of was bucking that trend for a while, but has now joined the slowdown, with the U.S. ISM going from 61 to 51. So clearly there is a global growth slowdown underway, and this is obviously one of the reasons why the Fed feels like it has the option to cut rates here. Even like the natural rate, so-called R-star, is starting to drift lower by a few tenths of a percent. So I think the Fed is doing the right thing. But globally, China is, I think, my main concern. I mean, the weakness on the manufacturing side in Europe, especially Germany, you can sort of tie that to China weakness as well. And of course, Europe has a banking issue also. But China, it's reporting 6.2% growth, but my sense is that it's probably significantly less than that. And one of the big questions is that if the trade dispute gets resolved, and of course, China's economy presumably will do much better because it's more geared towards exports to the U.S. than the U.S. is geared towards imports from China. But if that doesn't happen, you wonder if China needs to pull out the big bazooka in terms of stimulus like they did in 2016. And if they do that, what does that do to the currency, to the yuan? Does it break 7? So yes, it does concern me, but I think the central bank pivot basically around the world will help in that sense. And, China and the EMs are already easing policy in anticipation of the Fed rate cut. So the Fed cutting rates does give the EMs room to do more stimulus.
Jurjen Timmer, thank you so much for joining us. Jurjen is Director of Global Macro for Fidelity Investments, joining us in our Bloomberg Boston studio. Thank you so much for joining us.
The tension between Iran and the U.S., as well as the European Union, is rising. The latest is that Iran has accused a number of people of being in a CIA spy network and has sentenced them to death. Joining us now to talk about these tensions and what the potential fallout could be, both on a geopolitical standpoint as well as on oil markets, Ariel Cohen, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council, joining us from Washington, D.C. Ariel, can you just first start by putting the latest accusations of these individuals being CIA spies. Can you please put that into perspective for us?
Yes, of course. First of all, it's a tragedy that people, most probably some of them innocent or all of them innocent, have been arrested, dragged to the infamous Evin prison in Tehran, where they would be tortured and executed. Some of these people may be known assets. Any intelligence service worth its metal would track people who collaborate with foreign intelligence services, so at any time they can pick them up and then arrest them or kick them out of the country. This is a known tradecraft. However, the fact that President Trump tweeted that this is fake news makes me think that maybe Iranians just picked up some random opponents of the regime. After all, the urban and educated population hates the regime in Iran. And they may have been using this to settle scores, to punish people that are pro-Western or pro-American, but not spies. And that have been going on in Iran, that have been going on in Turkey, and in other places.
So, Ariel, I wonder if you could just set the stage for us a little bit. There's so many moving pieces going on with Iran and the U.S. and other Western nations. In your opinion, what do you think President Trump's strategy is as it relates to Iran?
Well, the good question is, does he have one? Does he have a strategy beyond trying to squeeze Iran by imposing sanctions? And we saw from the leaked emails from the former British ambassador who said there's no strategy in building a coalition, reaching out to our European allies. And also, once you impose this pressure on the Iranian regime, granted, this is a very significant pressure, more than anything we saw under the Obama administration. What happens when you corner Iran? Do you have enough deterrent power to prevent Iran from doing what it's doing now? It conducted 7 attacks on tankers and other boats in the Gulf. It may fire rockets, use proxies throughout the Middle East, from Lebanon to Yemen. It has militias that they support. However, what makes sense here is that the more you squelch the cash flow for that regime, the less money they have for the mischief. And then the question is, when you relent, when you stopped pressure because of the negotiating process, would they go back next day to do what they've done so far that caused this thing in the first place?
Well, but Ariel, let's go at it from the other point of view, because you have Iran. Clearly, tensions are already very high. They're suffering due to sanctions, and they don't want to go back to having their finances completely cut off. And yet, the UK government has accused them of seizing these tankers. Now there is the accusations of the CIA actors that are, as you just described.
Alleged.
So what are they playing at? What are they looking for?
They are playing tough. You need to understand the strategic culture of these countries. Of each country is not the same as the other. North Koreans are not the same as Iranians. And the Iranians are playing tough. We're not, you know, folding. We're not bending. We can escalate. What they're involved now is piracy. We haven't seen that level of disruption of international shipping, at least since Somalia pirates or the Iran-Iraq war in the 1980s. I remember how President Reagan and President Bush reflagged tankers, put American flags on them, and provided American naval assets to guard the shipments of oil. And in the end of the day, what broke the spirit of the Iranians, it when by mistake, U.S. Navy shot down an Iranian civilian aircraft. So I'm not suggesting anything horrible like that. But what I'm suggesting is if you want to negotiate, we have to negotiate from a position of strength. And this is something we see the British are ignoring. The British are failing to provide sufficient strength to stop the Iranians from seizing their tankers. So it looks to me like it has to be a U.S., British, and possibly other countries that are involved in oil shipping, maybe the Japanese, maybe other Europeans. But without negotiating from the position of strength, the Iranians have no incentive to negotiate, and we have no incentive to negotiate from the position of weakness. We need to show that we mean business. We need to put more naval vessels and guard the caravans that ship oil, right, and make it very clear for the Iranians that if they mess it up, if they disrupt the energy shipment in the Gulf, they will pay a very high, unsustainable price for that regime.
Ariel Cohen, thank you so much for joining us. Ariel Cohen is a senior fellow with the Atlantic Council from Washington, D.C., giving us his thoughts on the Iranian issue as tensions continue to rise.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Well, we just celebrated the moon landing of Apollo 11, which is prompting renewed discussion about the U.S. space program and its future. Our next guest can help us fill in some holes there. Safi Bakal is an author and physicist. He's based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Safi, thanks so much for joining us. I wonder if you could just give us a sense of where the U.S. space program is today.
Well, we're celebrating this week the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, which was one of the great inspiring events of human history. And then the U.S. has led the world in space and science and technology for the last 50 years. But after that peak in the 60s and then the 70s, we gradually slowed down. And the question is why? Why should we give up that leadership? Because that leadership drove so much of the economy. And what's happening today is that NASA's role has shrunk because of competition from private industry, competition from the military, and we haven't had that spirit that we had so many years ago. And now the new race is with China, with Russia, and with India. And it's so important to understand this because we don't want to see, for example, the first colony on the moon being a Chinese colony or a Russian colony. We want that would just
why
be
not?
That would be an admission of defeat. That would be an admission that our best years leading the world in science and technology are behind us, and I don't think they are.
But what would you say to people who say that that's spending a lot of money on the part of the United States to basically beat our chests, saying, you know, we're the best on the Hill?
I think those people fail to understand what was so important 50 years ago was the inspiration to young people, old people, average age people, just how powerful the idea of astronauts, the idea of exploring, the idea of space, and that ability to inspire our young people is a national advantage.
Well, I like, you're also, Safi, the author of a Wall Street Journal bestseller, and I love this title, Loon Shots, How to Nurture the Crazy Ideas That Win Wars, Cure Diseases, and Transform Industries. When I think about that kind of mentality, a couple people that jump to mind are Richard Branson and Elon Musk. And not surprisingly, I guess, they're on the forefront of what might be the next wave of space travel.
Well, I love what Elon Musk is doing. He's taking a big, bold approach to getting, for example, to Mars, and that's forcing NASA to react. That happened, almost the exact same playbook happened 30 years ago with another crucial big science project, and that was the sequencing of the human genome. big project, incredibly important for medicine, for human health. Federal government had a 15-year, $3 billion plan, and a young billionaire in his early 40s came up and said, forget that. I have a faster, better, bolder way to do it. The two of them together challenged each other and raised the bar and did a much better job than either one alone. And that's what's playing out again with Elon Musk and NASA. So I'm delighted to see that.
Your mother was a prominent scientist with NASA, as was your father. What did your mother think of this book that you wrote?
Oh, my mother, I've had people from NASA reach out to me as
and
well.
And what did they say?
They want to nurture loonshots faster and better because the big ideas, the ones that truly change the course of science, business, or history, rarely arrive with blaring trumpets or red carpets dazzling everybody with their brilliance. They usually are dismissed or neglected for years or even decades, and their champions written off as crazy. And NASA understands, as does the Army, as does the Air Force, as do CEOs, that we need more of those.
So if NASA isn't making the big investments that a lot of people think are necessary to sort of cultivate this sort of culture of innovation, what's the sort of expense here? I mean, are we losing prospective NASA scientists and just scientists in general who might otherwise get wrapped in and nurtured and brought into the fold for these loonshot explorations?
Well, it's absolutely important to have this federal government investment in research and science and technology and the ideas people think might be just enormously crazy. That gave us, for example, the transistor, the internet, GPS, the personal computer industry. That's why that kind of investment in nurturing loonshots helped the U.S. lead the world in science and technology. And I think we lost our way for 10 or 20 years, but I'm seeing signs of a turnaround. With the recent announcement that we're definitely going to Mars, with the recent announcement we're going to try to establish a colony, a permanent location on the moon, NASA trying to reach out and explore crazy new ideas, I think things are turning around, and I hope we can compete and beat China, India, and Russia to those milestones.
Is this administration supportive of those types of investments?
I do believe it is. And okay. I believe you're seeing the NASA budget increase. Certainly the inbound calls that I've gotten from NASA or even the military or intelligence agencies about wanting to nurture loonshots. How do we organize to nurture these crazy ideas faster and better? I've had a flood of those calls just in the last few weeks. And I think there's something has ignited. And I think it may be the competition with China.
How closely tied is the military to NASA?
They're entirely separate.
The reason why I ask is because some people say that it is actually a national defense issue with respect to having a greater dominance in space. Do you adhere to that at all?
I think having a greater dominance in space means a greater competitive advantage in science and technology and engineering, and that benefits everybody. It benefits NASA, it benefits science, it benefits national security, and it benefits our companies, our U.S. companies, our U.S. technologies, and our intellectual base, our intellectual capital for the future, which is the education of our young people.
Well, it seems like when I look at Elon Musk and his space program, he's doing some amazing things. I just seeing video of the rockets that actually land after use. That's a strikingly new technology. Is there a sense that NASA will work with some of these private players as well?
NASA's absolutely made it clear that they want a partner. And that is incredibly important. That's exactly the right attitude. That's exactly what worked 20, 30 years ago with the Human Genome Project. The federal government, national research sponsored the basic technology that got us the biotech industry. And then all sorts of private industry worked with the federal government. And because of that, the U.S. leads the world in healthcare and in drug discovery. And I think the same thing is starting to play out in space science.
Thank you so much. This is really, really interesting. Safi Bakal, author and physicist from Cambridge, Massachusetts. He is also the author of the Wall Street Journal bestseller, Loonshots, How to Nurture the Crazy Ideas That Win Wars, Cure Diseases, and Transform Industries. I love the idea of loonshots.
Yes, very cool. Time to check in with Bloomberg Opinion. We're joined by opinion columnist Brooke Sutherland. Brooke, I know you cover all things industrials. We're right smack in the middle of the second quarter earnings period. It was kind of a mixed week last week. I think about CSX on the downside. Some of the other names had kind of some mixed results. You think there might be even some more rocky roads coming up here for the earnings?
Yeah, I mean, I think it really depends on what expectations are going into earnings. And so last week we saw CSX sell off more than 10% on its earnings report. And I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that the stock was up almost 30% going into earnings, which signals to me that people thought this was going to be a relatively safe place to hide out. And they were wrong in that assessment. But then you had names like J.B. Hunt and Union Pacific that actually, you know, got a little nice pop off their earnings. And I think that just was because expectations had been lowered so much going into that. But there are a fair amount of names that are like a CSX that people have been sort of piling into, and I wonder if those are as defensive as people think they are.
Like what?
Well, another name that I think about is Honeywell, which did actually report earnings last week, and they were good. I don't want to take away from it, but they had some of the same slowdown trends that we're seeing elsewhere in the industry, particularly in some of their shorter sales market, like their productivity and sales division. Organic growth for the quarter was a little bit weaker than analysts expected. I mean, they still had overall 5% organic sales growth, so it's not like the sky is falling, but I do wonder, you know, especially given the struggles that GE has had and 3M has had, there's been a lot of people piling into Honeywell, and what's really keeping that stock alive is aerospace.
Right.
But if that starts to crack at all, then that can be rather problematic.
When industrials don't do well, people often say, look, this is a sign of the trade war. This is a sign of a slowing macro economy. I'm wondering, based on what you're saying, whether that's an inaccurate narrative, whether it's more that people have just overpriced these shares heading in and are expecting too much, and it's more just sort of taking off some of the profits from earlier in the year. Is that a better way to look at it?
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, I think they're definitely feeling the pain of the trade war uncertainty. I mean, that's a big part of why you're seeing some of these sales numbers come down. They're citing people not really being comfortable with moving forward with these new investments. But on the other hand, I think you have this weird dynamic where investors don't really have anywhere to go. Are you going to, you know, pile into overpriced equities? Or are you going to go into low yielding bonds? I mean, like, what are your options here? And I do think there's this misperception about the way that an interest rate cut can play out for industrial companies. This whole idea that a 25 basis point cut is going to spur this new rash of investments and like machinery purchases among industrial companies, I just don't buy it. The cost of debt is very low. It's been low for years. All of these companies had a huge influx of cash from the tax overhaul. I don't think any of them are sitting around saying, you know what, if I can just get that 25 basis point cut, I'm going to build a new factory. I'm going to buy a new, giant piece of machinery. And so I just don't know that that's going to be the saving grace that some investors would seem to think it is, just given where some of these stocks are trading.
Well, one of your favorite names I know is Boeing. Back in the news today, downgrade or the outlook of revised to negative from stable by Fitch. And I know the Southwest Air CEO is out talking about how they're still looking at the 737 MAX. And if it's not there, they're going to have to make other plans, I guess. What's the latest that you expect to hear from Boeing?
So Boeing did come out last week and they said they're going to take a $4.9 billion after-tax charge in the second quarter. And that represents their estimate at this point in time for what they're going to compensate the airlines for keeping the MAX grounded. Now, importantly, that does not include any litigation costs or settlements with families or anything like that. That would all be separate. And they did also say they were going to expect $1.7 billion in increased costs. And that has to do with taking down production of the MAX to accommodate the surplus of inventory they have built up. They're basing all of that on the expectation that the MAX comes back early in the fourth quarter. That to me seems optimistic. And it does give me pause because again and again, you have Boeing with the most aggressive timeline. I remember they back in March were saying they would have all the paperwork into the FAA by the end of March for a fix. And then we've subsequently seen all of these negative headlines coming out about the fact that some of these planes weren't, you know, the sensors that were tied to that flight software system that's been blamed for the two crashes weren't operational on some of the planes as they'd promised. Then there's a separate issue with a microprocessor. And I wonder what the value is in being the most optimistic, aggressive one in the room at this point in time, if you're Boeing. And I do think, you know, there is a risk that this does slip into 2020 just because the FAA is obviously incentivized as well to protect its reputation, make sure they coordinate with international regulators. and make sure this thing is safe before you get it back in the skies.
It all sounds really bad. Boeing shares down, though, 0.9%. Not a huge decline, as a lot of bad news already is baked in. Investors kind of shrugging with a Fitch downgrade. Yep. Baser putting in a watch saying, all right, guys, I mean, we know it's not a great situation. Brooke Sutherland, thank you so much for being with us. Brooke Sutherland is deals and industrials columnist for Bloomberg Opinion.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg P&L podcast. You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Paul Sweeney. I'm on Twitter at PT Sweeney.
I'm Lisa Abramowitz. I'm on Twitter at Lisa Abramowitz 1. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.